Director of the Department of Environmental Conservation's Office of Climate Change, and an appointed member of the Climate Action Council Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel. Over the past few months, it has been my privilege to coordinate the work of members of this advisory panel, members of other advisory panels, and a large number of state agency staff in their efforts to develop adaptation and resilience recommendations to propose to the Climate Action Council for inclusion in the scoping plan under development by the council. Materials providing both detailed information on the proposed recommendations and a summary were posted with the announcement of this meeting at climate.ny.gov. Today's meeting is intended as an opportunity for interested members of the public to comment on those proposed recommendations. The Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel, as well as its supporting staff working group, will consider all relevant input it receives as it prepares its final proposed recommendations to the climate or proposal to the Climate Action Council. Before we begin taking comments, I will take some time to describe the process by which the current proposed recommendations were developed, as well as the next steps, and provide a high-level overview of the proposed recommendations. But I think it would also be useful to first quickly review the provisions of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act itself, so that everyone involved today can better understand the context in which the adaptation and resilience recommendations are being proposed. Since the CLCPA's enactment in July 2019, most public attention has been focused on its very aggressive greenhouse gas emission reduction requirements, essentially that New York State reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 40% of their 1990 levels by 2030 and by 85% of their 1990 levels by 2050. To help achieve these required emission reductions, the law requires the Public Service Commission to achieve a number of renewable energy and energy efficiency targets. However, under the law, it is essentially DEC's responsibility to adopt regulations to ensure emissions do not exceed the limits set by the law. DEC's regulations are to be guided by the recommendations of a scoping plan to be developed by a Climate Action Council, which comprises the heads of 12 state agencies and 10 additional appointees. Pursuant to the CLCPA, the panel has appointed 7 advisory panels to assist in developing recommendations, including the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel, and the council is further advised by the Climate Justice and Just Transition Working Groups. Now, I want to pause here and make one important point. Neither the Climate Action Council nor the panels that it has convened have any regulatory authority. They are all advisory only, and I just want to make sure that folks understand that neither the council nor the panel have the authority to put in place regulations or to take any other sort of regulatory action. As I mentioned, the news media and the public have focused, properly so, attention on the greenhouse gas reduction aspects of the CLCPA. But the law also does address resilience to climate hazards and adaptation to changing climatic conditions. The Act amended the 2014 Community Risk and Resiliency Act by adding language that generally authorizes the Department of Environmental Conservation to support adaptation measures. And the amendments to the Community Risk and Resiliency Act require applicants to demonstrate consideration of climate change in general for major projects in most DEC permit programs. However, the law does not explicitly require the council to include adaptation and resilience recommendations in its scoping plan. Nevertheless, DEC Commissioner Dazzle Sagos, as co-chair of the Climate Action Council, has directed the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel to develop such recommendations for inclusion in the scoping plan. In turn, Sarah Kroll of the Department of State, who is the chair of the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel, asked me to convene a work group and to coordinate development of the adaptation and resilience recommendations. We, pursuant to that request, I have convened an adaptation and resilience group comprising members of the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel itself, members of the Land Use and Local Government Staff Working Group, state agency staff that had been convened to support the deliberations of the advisory panel. We have also asked each of the other advisory panels and the Climate Justice Working Group to designate at least one representative to the Adaptation and Resilience Group. We initially defined our scope to include recommendations to address risk associated with a small set of specific climate hazards, for example, sea level rise, flooding, and thermal extremes, with the intent that we would recommend no-regret solutions to these relatively well-understood hazards, while additional analysis and planning for addressing climate change in a more comprehensive way was underway. We also included in our scope recommendations related to community adaptation and resilience, statewide adaptation planning. And we worked with representatives of the other panels to identify climate risk specific to the greenhouse gas mitigation strategies those panels were recommending, so that we could incorporate actions to address those risks in the adaptation and resilience recommendations. In May, the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel will forward its proposed adaptation and resilience recommendations to the Climate Action Council, and we will present them to the Council at its June 8th meeting, which will also be open to the public. The selected adaptation and resilience recommendations will be included as a chapter in the Climate Action Council scoping plan, and the Council will have the authority to select the proposed recommendations to be included. So not everything you see today will be included, perhaps, and there's also a strong possibility that the recommendations that you're shown today in draft form will be amended or enhanced in some way. State agency staff will be responsible for drafting the narrative portions of the scoping plan for the recommendations that are selected for inclusion by the Council. However, unlike the greenhouse gas mitigation recommendations, which DEC is required by the law to consider in developing its regulations to achieve the required greenhouse gas emission limits, no entity, whether it be the governor, the legislature, state agencies, municipalities, businesses, et cetera, no entity is statutorily required to implement any of the selected adaptation and resilience recommendations. Now, before I begin an overview of the proposed recommendations, it's worth pausing for just a moment to reflect on why consideration of climate change is important and the effects of climate change is important. New York State's experience over the past few decades has been consistent with New York State-specific projections of climate change. We have experienced the effects of a changing climate as projected by numerous reports, including the National Climate Assessment and New York's own climate study. In particular, we have seen both higher average temperatures and more frequent high heat days and heat waves, more precipitation and more extreme precipitation events, while scientists tell us to expect more frequent short-term droughts. And we have seen about 1 inch of sea level rise per decade since the mid-19th century. Climate change threatens New Yorkers' health and well-being in many ways, including through decreased air quality and diseases transmitted by insects, food, and water. Our infrastructure, which represents significant community and public and other public investment, will be increasingly compromised by climate-related hazards, including sea level rise, coastal flooding, and intense precipitation events, leading to damaging and dangerous floods. And critical agriculture, fisheries and systems, and critical agriculture, fisheries and ecosystems will be increasingly affected over the next century by climate change impacts. So remembering that, the Adaptation and Resilience Group is currently proposing 11 initiatives, which are summarized on this slide and the next. Now, don't worry about memorizing them. We will return to each in a little more detail through this presentation. You will note that these are quite high-level initiatives. If you've done your homework by reviewing the posted materials, you know that each of these initiatives comprises several components, and that much more detail about each one is included on the slides in the full recommendation slide set. You will also note that the numbering of these initiatives has no real pattern except that the numbers are consecutive. The order should not be interpreted as indicating prioritization. Rather, the numbers have simply been assigned as the group went through a dynamic process of reorganizing, renaming, deleting, and adding initiatives. For the sake of time, I intend this afternoon to just quickly highlight a few of the components associated with each initiative, but we can come back to discuss any of the initiatives and its components during the discussion period, and we can also pull up and display the full recommendation slides during the comment period if anyone would like to discuss any of that more detailed material. We will, once we have finished developing the final recommendations, reorganize and renumber them before we actually present them to the Climate Action Council. But for now, we have organized them according to three basic themes, understanding that all these themes and the initiatives of which they are comprised overlap. The building capacity theme comprises four initiatives related to statewide planning. General consideration of future conditions wherever relevant in state decision making, enhancement of general understanding and adaptive capacity, and identifying options for financing adaptation and shifting risk. Looking at each of these four initiatives in a little more detail. Although I said that the order of these initiatives does not represent priority, in fact, I lied a little bit, because in fact, the first two components of this initiative and several of the other components I will mention in the building capacity theme are a high priority in the panel's opinion, because they will determine to a large extent the effectiveness of many of the other initiatives. The panel will recommend that the state recognize the importance of coordination of agency adaptation and resilience activities under high-level leadership in the form of a state resilience officer located in the executive chamber. The panel also acknowledges that the recommendations we are proposing constitute only a part of the work necessary to address the multitude of risks climate change poses, and recommends that the state invest the resources to develop a comprehensive state climate change adaptation and resilience plan. Mainstreaming of climate change considerations into existing programs is one of the most cost-effective actions available to us to prepare for a changing climate. This initiative would promote use of consistent science-based projections in state decision-making, provide design guidelines for state-funded projects, and incentivize the use of natural resilience measures. A theme that you will hear throughout this presentation is promotion of the use of natural resources and nature-based features to enhance resilience. This initiative would also set standards for consideration of climate vulnerabilities in state-funded planning, and would expand the list of climate hazards that the state infrastructure agencies would be required to consider pursuant to the Smart Growth Public Infrastructure Policy Act, which currently only requires consideration of hazards due to risk due to sea level rise, storm surge, and flooding. The third initiative in the building capacity category or theme is focused on ensuring that individuals have information related to climate risk that aids in their personal decision making and access to resources to enhance the resilience of their homes and businesses. It would establish the public education and awareness programs necessary to ensure public understanding of the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the same time we prepare for the effects of a changing climate. And it would include youth training programs with an emphasis on disadvantaged youth and support of local climate action. Of course, implementation of none of our recommendations will be free of charge. Further, the benefits of investments in adaptation and resilience are sometimes hard to calculate because they are often realized as avoided future costs rather than immediate reduction in expenditures, as is often the case with things like energy efficiency investments, for example. However, failure to invest now in resilience will inevitably cost New Yorkers more in the long run, leaving less money available to invest in greenhouse gas mitigation and other social benefit programs such as education. The panel believes that many, but not all, of its recommendations recommendations could be funded through a bond act, similar to the one that was recently approved to appear on the ballot this fall. In addition, mechanisms that both generate funding while incentivizing risk reduction activity or discouraging risk reduction behaviors should be explored. And changes to insurance programs may be necessary to ensure that risks incurred by a few are not unduly paid for by general taxpayers, while ensuring that policy owners are fully protected from climate hazards. We know that the effects of climate change are most directly felt at the local level. Assisting municipalities to prepare for and react to increasingly severe climate hazards is among the most important things the state could do, and many of the recommendations in this theme build on programs that are already in place. This initiative includes an expansion of state financial and technical support for community and regional adaptation planning and implementation, and for mainstreaming of climate change considerations into local planning and regulatory programs. It recognizes the value of planning for economic resilience and as well as environmental resilience, and it calls for an emphasis on ecosystem-based planning for adaptation. We have heard numerous times from local officials that they need funding, decision support tools, and direct assistance from trusted experts to properly assess climatic risk and to develop and implement meaningful adaptation plans. The need to reduce unacceptable levels of risk by retreating from some high-risk areas in a planned, orderly fashion is being increasingly recognized. The state should develop policies, guidance, and facilitation services to help communities identify such areas and to put in place pre-event long-term recovery plans for vulnerable areas. And recognizing that these plans may well include strategic retreat. And we must recognize the need to be prepared to assist municipalities as quickly and as effectively as possible after the inevitable next disaster, and to prepare for climate migration, both within the state and into the state. Work to mainstream consideration of climate change in environmental reviews, whether they be seeker reviews or permit reviews, is ongoing within DEC, pursuant to the Community Risk and Resiliency Act. But much remains to be done, as every permit program must be examined to determine the climate hazards that are relevant to each permit and project type, the types of information that are necessary to assess those risks, and appropriate revisions to permit issuance standards. Some programs, including legislative amendments to enhance regional planning while respecting home rule, will be important to implementing recommendations to enhance adaptability of our living ecosystems and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions associated with inefficient use of land for housing and other developments. Expedited review of some types of projects should be explored, taking care not to subvert the environmental review process or reduce public opportunities to participate in it. And we should develop our capacity to better assess the effects of agency actions and public investments, particularly infrastructure investments, on local economies and the local ability to adapt to future conditions. Flood risk has always been high in many parts of New York State, but increasing risk due to both sea level rise and more frequent severe precipitation is one of the more readily observable and damaging effects of climate change. Work at DEC and other agencies to reduce risks of flooding, including through local watershed assessments, more effective mapping is ongoing, but should be maintained or enhanced. Additional support for local actions to reduce flood risk in the form of incentives, direct funding, and technical support is also needed to fully address this increasing risk. Although the term thermal extremes can certainly include extreme cold as well as extreme heat, and both extremes can affect a range of vulnerable sectors, the panel decided to focus its immediate recommendations for short-term actions on the effects of extreme heat on humans, particularly disadvantaged individuals and communities that are which are particularly at risk due to extreme heat. Again, many of these programs are already in place, the efforts primarily of the New York State Department of Health, but continued work to enhance and expand these programs and improve their reach to disadvantaged communities is needed. I will note the recommendation to provide access to high efficiency air conditioning units or even heat pumps would require considerable funding, and efforts to improve weatherization as a health measure do align with weatherization efforts also intended to promote energy efficiency. As New York State shifts to a decarbonized energy system, improving the reliability and resilience of the energy system, as well as the reliance of those who depend on that energy system, will become more and more critical. And I'll note that this initiative includes at least two components, energy efficiency upgrades and support for microgrids that have substantial overlap with greenhouse mitigation recommendations that are coming from other panels. I'll also note that the panel acknowledges that the recommendation to maintain existing natural gas infrastructure as a resilience measure is potentially controversial and invites comments specific to that recommendation. The living system theme currently comprises two initiatives, one focused on natural ecosystems, the other on our important agricultural economy. The great conservationist Aldo Leopold said, "To keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering." And this initiative might be dubbed keeping all the parts. For many natural resources, the most effective way to allow them to adapt to a changing climate is to relieve non-climatic stressors and to provide ample space with appropriate habitats. This initiative provides for a variety of mechanisms to ensure conservation or protection of the most important pieces of our life-sustaining ecosystems. Components of this initiative would expand current support for regional, local, and private programs to support diversity protection. And other components of this initiative would improve regulatory oversight for important ecosystems such as wetlands and make spatial information more readily available to municipalities, developers, and other stakeholders. We also recommend expansion of funding to improve aquatic connectivity while reducing flood risk and promotion of natural resilience measures through amendments to the Corps of Engineers regional or nationwide permits. Concerns regarding siting of major energy infrastructure were a dominant theme throughout discussions this panel has had, both within the panel and with stakeholders. To a large extent, siting considerations will be addressed by other groups, but the Adaptation and Resilience Group does wish to note the importance of avoiding siting in areas of high value to wildlife and of mitigating the effects, the unavoidable effects when that siting in high value areas cannot be avoided. This initiative includes recommendations to better incorporate best management practices to protect threatened and endangered species into a variety of project types. And it includes recommendations to incentivize and support private forest stewardship that parallel those made by the that will be made by the Agriculture and Forestry Advisory Panel. And finally, in consultation with the members of the Agriculture and Forestry Advisory Panel, we are including some recommendations to improve farm water and energy efficiency and to incorporate other climate resilient practices into farm operations and to continue research and outreach to help our farmers prepare for the effects and opportunities presented by a warming climate. So that is a very high level overview of our recommendations. I'll take a moment to review the schedule so folks have, again, a little bit more appreciation of the context, and then we will open up for discussion there, questions and comments. I'll note that the Climate Action Council, all of this information, scheduling information is available at the Climate Action Council's website at climate.ny.gov. The council will meet next, commencing at 9 o'clock on April 12th, and we'll be hearing mitigation recommendations from, I believe, 4 of the advisory panels. And then the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel will meet on the 14th in the afternoon. That will be a final review of the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel's mitigation, greenhouse gas mitigation recommendation. So not a detailed discussion of the adaptation and resilience recommendations, but of the mitigation recommendations that this advisory panel will be forwarding. The 22nd is Earth Day. On May 4th, the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel will meet again. That will be the opportunity for the adaptation for the advisory panel itself to make its final review of these adaptation and resilience recommendations to be considered by the Climate Action Council. We will continue to take comment, public comment, and I'll describe how to continue commenting in a few moments. But we will continue to take comments on a rolling basis through the close of business of May 7th. But obviously, if you can see there that we are required to forward our final adaptation resilience recommendations to the council on May 14th. So the earlier you can provide any written comments that you intend to provide, the better chance you have that they will be included in the recommendations to the council. And in particular, the earlier we have them, the earlier, the higher your chance that they could be incorporated into the recommendations that are reviewed by the advisory panel itself on the 4th. On May 10th, at the council meeting, again, running from 9 to 4, these are long. The April and May council meetings will be quite long. The other advisory panels, including the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel, will take will present its mitigation recommendations to the council. And then on June 8th, presumably I will be presenting the adaptation and resilience recommendations to the council as well. Just in the long term then, under the law, the council has until the end of the year, the end of this year, end of 2021, to complete drafting its scoping plan. The final plan is due by the end of 2022. So 2022 will be the year for intense public comment and hearing on the entire scoping plan. And then DEC has until the end of 2023 to promulgate the regulations would achieve the intended to achieve the emission reduction requirements of the CLCPA. In some ways, that may look like a long, drawn-out schedule, but I can tell you from personal experience that the time to develop, to have a year to develop what are essentially economy-changing regulations is an extremely accelerated schedule, and it will be a very busy time for those of us who are writing those regulations. So, we've been showing this slide. We will you have your choice of either typing questions or comments into the chat feature. What I would ask you to do is please address any comments that you intend to make to all participants. That will ensure that they're actually recorded. Comments that are sent privately to me will not be recorded, and there's a good chance that I'm going to miss anything because as you can probably see from my eyes darting back and forth, I'm looking at several different screens and windows, so I'm not looking at every word that comes into the chat, and the only way to ensure that gets recorded for review later is to send it to all participants. You can send questions to the host via the chat. The host will at times relay questions to me. And I'm happy to provide short responses to clarifying questions, but we do not intend to engage in extended dialogue regarding these recommendations today. If there's a topic for which that kind of extended dialogue is warranted, we will arrange for that later. If you would like to make a verbal comment, please raise your hand. Those of you who are calling in via telephone may raise or lower your hand, as the case might be, maybe by pressing star 3. The host will, when she spots your hand, she will recognize you and unmute you so that you can verbalize your comment. And again, this meeting is being recorded, so we will have that information, and we will consider that. Well, I may or may not respond to the comment, and probably not. And again, we also encourage written comments, particularly any that are long or detailed. And you can submit, the materials are available at the Climate Action Council's website. If you would like to comment on the adaptation and resilience recommendations, you may send an email to LULG at Land Use and Local Government, LULG@dos.ny.gov, and those will be forwarded to me. Or you can, if you prefer to use postal mail, you may send them directly to me at DEC headquarters. Again, the comment deadline is May 7th. So with that, I will ask Emma, do we have any questions or anyone asking to make a comment?
Yes, we do have a couple hands raised, but I just want to say one note for folks who are chatting in the box. The option would be all panelists if you wanted to get to all of us here. So if you can choose all panelists when you're chatting in the box, it will get sent to, you know, Mark and all of our rest of our panelists. So without further ado, I have Claus Jacob. I'm going to unmute you soon, but first I'm going to, Mark, would you like to do the timer?
Do you have a lot of hands? Let's do that if you have a lot of hands. What we ask you to do is try to limit your comments to 3 minutes. And we have apparently a fancy timer to put up to help you stick to your time. So we'll try that. I've not used this before, so I'm eager to see how it works. But we can always, if we do cut you off and you have more to say and there isn't a cue to make comments, we can certainly come back to you.
Okay, so Andrea has our timer up, and I'm going to unmute you, Claus. So, all right, Claus, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're good to go.
Yes.
Okay, Mark, you mentioned that the Bond Act will be this November 1. Before, I thought it was 22.
I could be wrong. I thought it was included to be included in the, that the legislation authorizes to be included in the upcoming ballot. But to be honest, I did not check closely enough to be sure of that. So if there is someone who is sure of that, I may stand corrected.
Let's leave that aside, but it needs verification. My question is the following. I'm part of the Piedmont Waterfront Resilience Commission, which is part of it's an advisory committee to the French government in Piedmont, New York. And we have struggled with the following two items. And I would like to see recommendations possibly included by this committee. The New York State Building Code is somewhat behind the recommendations of CRRA, meaning it's not looking forward. It's taking current base flood elevation plus some freeboard, but CRRA has recommended to include lifetime and sea level rise projections for the future. It would be nice if recommendations could be included in this in these documents that makes the building code having that option to look forward. The second related issue is the building code does not include any amphibian options for buildings that sit on the ground and are being raised by the tides and sea levels.
Could you repeat that? I didn't quite catch what you said. Did you say it doesn't account for pluvian?
No.
I misunderstood.
It does not have any options for amphibian structures that sit on the ground but being raised by sea level rise, storm surges, and tides. And so we are handicapped because we are trying to develop a plan, and yet we cannot do that without having a building code in the state that allows us to do all the options.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I think up next we have Sebastian. Sebastian, I am going to unmute you.
Hey, everyone. Should I just go into it?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. My name is Sebastian Pelletieri. I'm the community science coordinator at Riverkeeper. I just wanted to thank everyone for putting this together, and especially to dedicating this attention to adaptation and resilience, which is something that wasn't, you know, kind of as prominently featured in the CLCPA. We submitted written comments as well that are a bit more detailed, but I just wanted to preface a little bit and give you guys a bit of an explanation of where we're coming from. So we really appreciate the Adaptation Resilience Subgroup in working to address not just climate change, but finding ways to help communities, ecosystems, rivers adapt and become more resilient to a changing climate. Water is the primary way through which most of these climate impacts are experienced, whether that be from droughts, flooding, sea level rise, or severe storms. Thus, adapting to and becoming climate resilient requires the inclusion and stewardship of water in all of its forms and uses. Riverkeeper believes that incorporating water into climate resilience means that we would reduce underlying pollution burdens to protect our waters from impacts such as harmful algae blooms, invest in infrastructure to reduce leaks and protect our drinking and wastewater treatment plants from sea level rise, manage water on a watershed scale to restore natural filtration and storage provided by healthy watersheds, and build communities around drinking water protection and watershed management in order to prepare for future challenges. We would also prioritize the reduction of water-related sources of greenhouse gas emissions that include, but are not necessarily limited to, sewage overflows and impoundments behind dams, both of which have been shown to emit methanes. And so we submitted slightly more detailed comments about the specific proposals that you all outlined or recommendations that you all outlined, but I wanted to provide a brief overview of where we're coming from. Thank you again to the committee for accepting these comments and for the public feedback period.
Thank you, Sebastian. I did just have a few moments to read through your very detailed and very helpful comments before the call started, so I appreciate those.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, so I don't have any other raised hands. Just Klaus and Sebastian, I just want to ask you if you could unraise your hands. But we do have some comments in the chat box. Not sure if you wanted to go through those.
I would say if there are questions, we don't necessarily need to, I think everyone can read comments, or if there are questions in there that we might be able to answer, you can try that. Mm-hmm. And I guess I can read the questions as well as you can. I see one question. I'll go in order here. Am I to understand that this work is an effort to collect data and suggestions to create a leadership document that will be presented to the powers that be, but there is no mandate to follow these recommendations? Yes, that's correct. That is the way the law is written. Those of us who are putting time and effort into this, I think would certainly agree that we hope that those powers that be seriously consider these recommendations. But there, again, there's no statutory requirement that anyone do so. Next question, do you specify that science-based climate projects be produced, shared with all state, county, municipal agencies and with all property owners and developers on a fixed schedule, such as a new set of models and projects be released in the fourth quarter of every year, which ends in 3.7 or 0. We didn't get into that specificity. I will note that the Community Risk and Resiliency Act, I should say that we haven't fleshed out that recommendation in sufficient detail that I can answer that specific question. I will note that the Community Risk and Resiliency Act requires that DEC update its MYCRR Part 490 projected sea level rise. That is the regulation that adopts official state sea level rise projections every 4 years. Every 5 years. So that was regulation was promulgated in 2017. So in 2022, we will have to update the sea level rise regulation. That cycle is embedded in the law. We will have to have a discussion about what is a reasonable cycle for updating projections. And of course, it's sometimes difficult to project how often relevant science is actually produced for any particular climate projection. But we will certainly be, from the DEC's perspective, I can say we will certainly continue to work with NYSERDA, which is a great partner in funding much of the work that leads to these, to the projections that we do have, and talk about what is a reasonable schedule. So thank you for that question. If climate change is accelerating, could the Climate Action Panel take less than 18 months to produce its final scope and plan so that DEC regulations could be issued before year end 2023? I would say sure, anything's possible, but it will be extremely difficult. If you're familiar with the rulemaking process in New York State, it is can be a drawn out process, even for non-controversial regulations. And I think we would be naive to think that these regulations would not involve controversy. The reality is DEC's Office of Climate Change and other involved units, such as the Division of Air Resources, are already thinking about the regulations that would likely be necessary even before we see what all the draft regulations are. But we are attempting to essentially get staff prepared because it will take, we could not start on December 1st of 2023 and January 1st of 2023 and hope that we could have regulations promulgated within 12 months. The process will actually have to start earlier, if behind the scenes, so that the public facing portion of that process would be running in 2023. The question, can we drill down a little further on watershed protection improvement districts? And I think that might refer to a recommendation that there be an amendment to New York town law. And essentially this, I will be honest, I'm not the expert in this area. These do not all represent things coming from just me. There are a lot of people contributed to this, but I believe the person who suggested this was thinking of this recommendation as a way to allow these districts, which are already authorized under New York town law, to serve as entities that could collect certain impact fees to provide funding to address the effects of climate change, to provide local funding to address climate change impacts at a local basis, and frankly, I am not prepared. I simply am not aware of all the ins and outs of what it would take to create those districts or to authorize them to do to assess these fees. I understand that it has occurred in some areas of the state. There are some states where some municipalities that do have such districts in one form or another. I also understand that they are authorized under four village and city law as well, but that it's not quite, the law is not quite as effective at the city or village level. And Nathan, if you would like to pursue that any further, certainly you can email me and I can try to get further information on that if you'd like.
Hey, Mark, we do have another question from actually from Simon Gruber. So Simon, I know you're joining on the phone, so I'm willing to unmute you. Hey, Simon, can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're good to go.
Hi. Thank you. Simon Gruber. I'm a fellow at the Institute for Sustainable Cities at Hunter College, CUNY, and chair of the Muja Creek Watershed Intermunicipal County here in Orange County, where I live. And my comment is, as I've spoken with Mark about in the past and others involved in this process, there are a large array, very broad and diverse array of benefits that we get from trees and green space in our communities, near buildings and in developed areas, is the main focus of this comment, that are relevant for health, energy efficiency, particularly on the cooling side, for cooling buildings and paved areas in hot weather, reducing stormwater runoff, which is heavily a big focus in the green infrastructure and stormwater management realm. And the energy efficiency benefits of trees, based on a lot of research I've been doing since around 2012, are not being used and factored in many ways where they should be, in my view. And one of the major problems is that from the perspective of NYSERDA, and to the extent I've been able to check with the Public Service Commission and many other people who are involved in these things, there's a feeling that there's not enough of concrete, clear numerical metrics on energy efficiency benefits of trees for buildings and energy use in developed areas to warrant spending on them, more investment. And in a very telling comment recently, I learned from the Arbor Day Foundation, which has a national perspective, that there's not a single state in the country where the public utility regulatory agency has accepted the available evidence that trees reduce energy use to warrant more investment in them by utilities and from funding sources like the systems benefit charge and all. So my recommendation is that I think the adaptation resilience track and the land use and local government panel are the best place in the current process to recognize the very broad array of benefits for a whole bunch of different things, including economic benefits for community development and Main Street revitalization, crime reduction, aggression reduction. The literature is abundant and growing all the time in published scientific work on these things. And there needs to be sort of a bit of a heavy lift to look at the cross-sectoral benefits to realize that there are so many different benefits from so many different realms. I hope that the state can see its way clear to get past this sense that, well, we really just still don't know enough and we shouldn't spend any money on this in a meaningful way, to put more funding into urban and community forestry in the DEC programs and find other ways to get this into many different tracks in many state agencies, including housing, health, community development, and others. That's my comment for today. And I will be putting in written comments with more detail. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon. Emma, do we have anyone else waiting, or Andrea?
No raised hands.
Okay.
There are comments in the chat.
Yep, I will keep reading through those then. On AR 11, AR stands for Adaptation Resiliency, in case you haven't figured that out. I've brought that up. The question is, could the last bullet recommendation calling for a comprehensive strategy for transitioning existing natural gas infrastructure to renewable natural gas or hydrogen translate to a further expansion of these pipelines in the name of power sector reliability and resilience? We're not prepared to answer that question, which is why we have framed this as develop a comprehensive strategy. This panel, I don't believe, is ready to say there should not be a further expansion in the name of resilience in some cases. On the other hand, I don't know that that the panel is willing to say there should be. We are admitting at this point that it is a topic that is controversial. Some people see it perhaps as a slippery slope, but others have indicated they think we should consider it. So if you, again, specific comments on that one in particular, we would certainly welcome. Yeah, and I stand corrected by a number of people in here. Thank you. The Bond Act would not go on the ballot until November 2022, which at least gives us time to figure out how we would use those funds in a way that's consistent. There is a question, where does the legislation define renewable energy? What fuel components are included in this definition? That's not really part of this group's work, but if I recall, I believe that the definition, well, I think there's actually a definition of renewable energy in the CLCPA itself, but it also may be in the renewable energy standard definition that the Public Service Commission has. But generally, renewable includes wind, water, solar, wind, hydro, and solar. And then the definition of clean energy typically adds nuclear to that definition. The question here is that state agencies will be, I think Mark said the state agencies will be providing more detail on each of the initiatives shortly. When will we be able to see this detail in the near future and before public comment periods begin? I think What I meant, whether it came through or not, was that there is more detail on the other slides. So there were two sets of slides posted with the meeting materials, one of which is a summary, which looked very much like many of the slides I walked through today. And then the other one gives a lot of detailed information in a format that we've been asked to use by the council. And understand that each of these seven advisory panels will be providing on the order of 100 or so slides to the council to review. So there's a lot of information that the council is going to be receiving on both mitigation and adaptation resilience recommendations. And so in hopes of trying to organize that information and better or make it easier to review, we were asked to provide the information and using those slide templates. So what I was referring to is actually the detailed slide templates that are currently available. I anticipate that, if you look carefully, you'll see that some of the words on the slides that I presented today are a little bit different than what we posted last week, because this is an ongoing rolling process. But before the May 4th meeting, I believe the Friday before that, April 30th, I anticipate posting another set of updated detailed slides as well as the summary slides, looking very much like this to reflect those comments and that input that we received between the last set that was posted last week and before in the next week or two that we're able to incorporate. There is some lag in the time it takes for us to finalize a set of slides and submit it. So we actually are providing, there's about a 9-day lag in the time from us to prepare a set of slides and then have it posted. But we will certainly do our best to incorporate any comment that we receive on a rolling basis, so that what you actually will see again on May 4th, April 30th, would represent the most recent version that we can provide. There's a question: will the government assume any responsibility for private properties adjacent to the ocean, bay, sound, et cetera, affected by rising sea water levels? And frankly, I don't know I don't know how to answer that question. I'm not really sure what that means. There is no plan at this point for government to take responsibility in terms of being obligated to buy it or somehow make some payments, if that's the question. Some of our recommendations do go to the point of supporting communities as they decide whether or not how to deal with seawater rising sea levels, and to determine if properties should be evacuated, if you will, retreated from. I believe that the Bond Act, some of the projects that have been named as potential eligible project types for the Bond Act that will be on the ballot in 2022, would include potential for strategic buyouts. We're a long way from that point at this right now. Could you please explain how this proposal would strengthen protection of wetland adjacent areas? It may be buried in the wording one of the things that we are, and what I mean by what does the questioner mean by a wetland adjacent area? For both freshwater wetlands and tidal wetlands that are protected by either ECL, Environmental Conservation Law Article 24 for freshwater, or ECL Article 25 for tidal wetlands, the areas within a certain distance of the actual wetlands also have some level of protection, in that Some activities are permitted in those adjacent areas, while others are not permissible or require permits to take place. And understanding that the values of a wetland accrue to both the wetland itself, but also in the adjacent areas. So one of the concerns is that as sea levels rise, areas that are now adjacent areas to tidal wetlands in particular will eventually become the wetlands themselves. And the areas landward will be the future adjacent areas. And so one thought in this has not been fleshed out. We don't know what the legislature would be able, what the legislature would be willing to do, because this is, much of this is subject to statutory authority, that we could regulate activities in current adjacent areas in a way that anticipates the fact that these will be the wetlands in the future, and to protect them in that way, in some ways. So again, details have yet to be worked out, and you know, someone would have to put that forward presumably as a statutory amendment to give the department additional authority to have additional regulation in the adjacent areas. But you know, if we don't do that, one of the concerns is that if, for instance, we build in these adjacent areas, and particularly if we build things like roads, then as sea levels rise and the tidal marsh move, the tidal wetland moves landward to a certain extent, you know, ahead of that sea level rise, when it comes up against a barrier like a railroad bed or a road or a bulkhead, it can no longer migrate, and then it will drown in place. And at that point, we lose all those wetland values, the natural values, potential beach access, and even the carbon sequestration value. So there is good reason for us to look at perhaps better protecting these adjacent areas. I hope that answers the question. Okay, and Klaus has reiterated his points. Thanks, Klaus. Yes, you're right. I was wrong. As I've already pointed out, the ballots will be on the 2022, November 22. The Bond Act will be on the 2022 ballot. We actually have a recommendation in the that the New York State Building Code could be updated to include flood resilience measures, to be forward-looking. And in fact, there is an executive order for us to do that. So that's actually something that we are that the Department of State is to be working, which manages the building code, is to be working on that. And part of the challenge is to garner the resources it actually takes to put together the case for how we should do that in a way that would meet the requirements of the New York State Codes Council. But that's in there. And to include workable regulations for amphibian structures. That's interesting, and certainly take that to heart under advisement, as we say. We haven't considered that, but certainly that's a useful recommendation. All right, I don't see any more questions. I see some comments. Folks reiterating what they've said, which is useful. Capture that in the chat. Emma or Andrea, any other questions? Any other raised hands?
No more raised hands, and I don't see anything else in the chat box. I think we're good here.
All right, so we have talked everyone into submission. Good. We certainly appreciate everybody's attention. I will put up the comment direction slide one more time if folks need to grab any of that information. And I would say going once, going twice. My contact information, or sort of the office's contact information, and if you have questions or comments to be directed to me, you can certainly send them through the climate change email box and they will get to me. And I certainly appreciate everybody's attention, very useful comments that we have received, and I look forward to reviewing additional comments over the next week or so. I want to thank Andrea Linton and Emma Antolos, who have served as our hosts today, both with our DEC's Office of Communication Services, and it certainly adds to the experience. Makes it a lot easier for those of us who are presenting to have competent technical help, and we certainly appreciate that. So with that, I will wish everyone a good afternoon, and we'll probably talk to many of you later. Thank you.
Mark, I have saved the chat, so we are good to go.
Great. Thank you.
No problem.